Trump and Putin face to face today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Presidents Trump and Putin meet for more than 2 hours on the sidelines of the G20. This reporter says the scene was both surreal and kind of normal.
Glad handling, clapping each other on the back, you know, making little jokes, which, by the way, is what world leaders do when they meet. It's just in this particular case, it's Putin, the guy who hacked the election, and Trump, the guy who hacked it for.
We'll get the latest from Hamburg and a take from the Kremlin-backed Russia Today. Plus, Trump's travel ban includes grandparents, so this woman started posting photos of them online.
Photos of them drinking tea or making a meal. You know, like, these grandparents are just like everybody else's.
The banned grandmas of Instagram, ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. Presidents Trump and Putin have officially met for the first time. The meeting took place at the G20 summit in Hamburg, Germany. It was scheduled to last 30 minutes, but went on for more than 2 hours. Afterwards, U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said there was positive chemistry between the two. Tillerson said Trump began the meeting by pressing Putin on Russian interference in the U.S. election.
They had a very robust and lengthy exchange on the subject. The president pressed President Putin on more than one occasion regarding Russian involvement. President Putin denied such involvement, as I think he has in the past.
They also agreed on a ceasefire in southern Syria starting Sunday. We spoke to Washington Post reporter David Filipov as this meeting was going on. He was at the press conference the two leaders gave before they went to hash things out behind closed doors.
The expectation, of course, is that they're going to be confronting each other over all sorts of issues. And instead, they're sort of glad handling, clapping each other on the back, making little jokes, which, by the way, is what world leaders do when they meet. It's just in this particular case, it's Putin, the guy who hacked the election, and Trump, the guy he hacked it for.
What did the two look like when they sat together? What were the kind of what was the scene?
Well, they're sitting in two white comfy chairs. And, you know, we're looking for none of that kind of sort of grim, hanging their heads thing, like the first meeting with Angela Merkel. Remember that one where he didn't shake her hand? The meeting looked comfortable. They looked like, you know, they were taking each other both seriously. You know, they both said the right words. It's an honor to meet you. I'm delighted to be here. You know, that whole sort of kind of good feeling, like two people who are going to get along, getting together.
Vladimir Putin has dealt with a number of U.S. presidents. You've been covering Russia for a while. How does this meeting stack up against those other meetings?
Well, I mean, it's really because of the expectation. Never in our lifetime have we had a summit with a Russian leader in the middle of an investigation that same Russian leader allegedly meddled in our election system to help the person he's summiting with. If that makes sense to you. This is a unique experience in the history of the United States and Russia. Bizarre to the point of being almost absurd, and yet it's happening. So there's sort of this one level where it's Russia and the United States, the two nuclear superpowers, and then another level where it's Trump and Putin, you know, the experienced op and the outspoken real estate reality guy. And then it's investigator and investigatee.
I keep reading in all the reports that this is a meeting on the sidelines. So I keep imagining Putin and Trump on a couch next to the elevator. I mean, what does that mean, the sideline meeting?
It's G20 summit ease for. There's a big summit. This isn't part of the official program. So they go off into a meeting room or to a different location and they sit down. It's an expected part of the program and people do it all the time. It's a chance to have a summit without having to do all the preparations and all the protocol and all the security, because somebody else already did that for you.
What do you think Trump hopes to get out of this meeting?
Trump is always hoping to get out of it that the world looks at Donald Trump and says he's making America great again. Look, he has to hate it that there is any question about his legitimacy, the legitimacy of his victory, the legitimacy of his representation of the United States. So by having a dignified meeting where he walks away with Putin, letting the world know he stood his ground, he, you know, was treated like the world leader he is, that's good. That's a win for him. But that's also a win for Putin, because what does Putin want? He wants to come out of this with not a word being said about meddling. And just sort of, hey, whatever differences we had, that was the last administration. You and me are going to make deals moving forward. It's U.S.-Russia partners like we should be.
Are we all overhyping this meeting?
You cannot overhype the first meeting between a U.S. president and a Russian president since they have so many nuclear weapons. So them shaking hands and smiling and walking away is great for all of us, regardless of what that means, right?
David Filipov reporting from Hamburg for The Washington Post. Thanks, David.
Thank you.
The Kremlin-funded news network, formerly known as Russia Today, was also following Trump and Putin's first face-to-face very closely. Alexei Kuznetsov is RT's deputy head of news. He's in Moscow, and he says it was clearly an interesting meeting.
The very fact that it lasted almost twice as long as had been originally planned speaks for the fact that, they definitely had a lot to talk about. And this meeting actually seemed to be conducted in a more amicable atmosphere than had been originally expected. Thirdly, that there were no hawks from the Trump administration present at the meeting, as had been predicted, which was a good sign.
Did you say no hawks at the meeting?
Yeah, no hawks. There were previous rumors that people like Fiona Hill, who is the National Security Council Director for Russia and Europe, might be present at the meeting, but she was absent. So it was just Trump and Putin and Lavrov, Russian Foreign Minister, and Tillerson. So obviously it was a much more friendlier atmosphere than it could have been.
Now, Putin and Trump seem to share the idea that Western media today stand in the way of their agendas. I'd like to play you a bit of RT Editor-in-Chief Margarita Simonyan. She's speaking at a forum, and President Putin and Chinese leader Xi Jinping are looking on. Here's what she says, and I'm hoping maybe you can translate it for us.
Почему это важно? Потому что мы живем в уникальные времена, когда пресса так называемая.
I know the quote very well because I heard it before. She was basically trying to convey the idea that sometimes the mass media usurp the power of directing the relations between countries and trying to dictate or change the values in various nations. Basically, assuming the role of real authorities.
So, in some ways, that's what Trump believes as well, isn't it?
I don't think so. I mean, it's difficult for me to answer. But I mean, obviously, Trump has an issue with his own media. I don't think that that the BBC has been called fake news, but CNN definitely has. But clearly, there's some bad blood between President Trump and the media. I don't think that Putin is in the same boat or is in the same situation with Trump. Putin feels pretty comfortable with his domestic media, and you can, guess why.
But I'm wondering, you're a journalist, and the head of your organization, with your own president looking on, is more or less calling for the media to fall in line with the Kremlin's agenda. Isn't the role of the press first and foremost to question the government instead of working hand in glove with it?
Well, obviously it is, but some media are financed by the government, it is quite obvious and logical that they would be trying to convey the Russian national side, if we're talking about RT. At least, I mean, that's the case with the American media that are financed by the government.
There isn't much American media financed by the government.
Well, there's still some.
So let's go back to this Trump-Putin meeting and the whole G20 meeting. What kind of tough questions will you be asking Vladimir Putin about it?
Well, we need to see first what kind of feedback he gives on the meeting with Trump.
But as a journalist and, you cover the government, we cover each other's governments, the natural inclination for a journalist is to not always accept what a leader will say. I mean, are there certain areas of Putin's government or the Russian government that you always feel like you got to push him pretty hard because you're just not sure what's really going on?
Yeah, but I don't think that either of the side will be inclined to hide anything from the media. So I guess that we can get only as much as we can get out of both the U.S. president and the Russian president. I mean, what would you push President Trump or President Putin specifically on?
I guess if I were you, I'd be really interested to find out whether President Trump asked Vladimir Putin about the alleged hacking of the U.S. election, which intelligence officials in the U.S. are very certain of, that it leads back to Russia and leads back to Vladimir Putin.
Well, I guess you're flipping the facts here a little bit. If you read the ODNI report, you can see that the intelligence officials in the United States are not very certain about the alleged Russian hacking.
Well, I guess we'll have to agree to disagree about the intelligence findings about the Russian hacking in the election, because it's very well established here.
I'm referring you to the original document. Okay. I can send you a link.
We'll agree to disagree. Alexei Kuznetsov is the deputy head of news at RT, the Kremlin-funded news network, formerly known as Russia Today. Thanks a lot for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
The operators of nuclear facilities and other power plants in the U.S. got an unsettling message last week. It came from the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security. Their report warned that for months now, hackers have been targeting these facilities across the U.S. and abroad. The New York Times got a copy of that report, and Nicole Perlroth is the reporter who broke the story. Nicole, what do we know so far about the companies that were targeted?
Well, we know hackers have targeted companies in the energy sector, specifically nuclear facilities, industrial control systems. We know they've targeted critical manufacturing systems, and we know they've targeted companies in the oil and gas sector.
Some news outlets are reporting that Russians are suspected of carrying out these attacks. Has the New York Times been able to pin down who's behind them?
We reported that as well, but the thing is, it's really early in this stage to say who exactly is responsible. All that investigators have told me is that for now, the MO of these hackers very much matches a group that the security industry calls Energetic Bear, which is basically just the security industry's nomenclature for a group of Russian hackers. We don't know exactly who they are, but a group of Russian hackers that have been targeting the energy sector for some time, dating as far back as 2012.
So we don't know who these attackers are who've been attacking these facilities, but do we have a sense of what they're after?
What made this particular series of hacks disturbing was that they were really targeting nuclear facilities quality control engineers, the very people who have access to the operational systems, which I have to back up and note that at a nuclear facility, the operation systems, which control the nuclear power plant itself, and the corporate computer network are separate networks. So far, we know that hackers have been able to compromise their corporate networks and have attempted to cross that digital divide into their operational systems. Why? We don't know. I mean, in the past, there's been a number of cyber attacks that are aimed at stealing blueprints and trade secrets from some of these facilities so that other countries can use that to broaden out their own energy programs and nuclear programs, or they could be aimed at a future attack that's more destructive. And we just don't know if this attack is aimed for espionage or aimed at destruction. But the attack that comes up again and again that shows what could be done with a destructive attack of this kind is actually one that the U.S. and Israel launched against Iran back in 2010.
That was Stuxnet.
Yes. And what Stuxnet did is they used a computer worm to get into the operational controls that powered Iran's nuclear uranium facility, and specifically the ones that controlled how fast its centrifuges were spun. In the process, they successfully destroyed a fifth of Iran's centrifuges. So they really set back Iran's nuclear program. Now, those same techniques could have been used to spin those centrifuges so out of control that they caused an explosion. There's a whole bunch of very, very scary things that can happen. But it's important to know that in this case, hackers were not successful, as far as we know, in crossing that digital divide from their victims' corporate networks into their operational networks for now.
Nicole Perlroth is a reporter with the New York Times. Thanks for speaking with us, Nicole.
Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up, why some gay men and women are getting married to each other in Britain. It's on the world.
Support for this podcast comes from LegalZoom.com. LegalZoom built a nationwide network of independent attorneys who can provide legal advice and answer all the day-to-day questions you have about running a small business. And since LegalZoom's not a law firm, there are never any expensive hourly fees. All pricing is given up front. For a special $10 discount, please visit LegalZoom.com/world. LegalZoom, where life meets legal. LegalZoom.com/world.
I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. If you look it up in the dictionary, the expression marriage of convenience came into use in the early 1700s. It's a union formed solely for pragmatic reasons, often financial ones. Makes you think of Jane Austen. But there's another kind of marriage of convenience happening in Britain now, in South Asian communities. Gay men and women are getting married to each other to keep their families happy. My BBC colleague Mobeen Azhar has produced a documentary about it called My Big Fake Straight Wedding. Mobeen, what is a marriage of convenience in this context?
Well, I think we're used to hearing about the marriage of convenience when it's to do with things like immigration status. But in this particular context, it's about projecting an image of yourself which is straight, and it's about fitting in. So it's about moving away from the real authentic identity, which might be gay or lesbian. And it's about projecting this image of yourself, which is being straight and entering a heterosexual marriage. You need to understand, and I'm sure many listeners will understand, that particularly in South Asian cultures, sexuality is something that is still hugely taboo. People don't talk about their sexuality in an open way, and they certainly don't talk about their sexuality if they are not heterosexual. And so what we might call coming out or being open about homosexuality or being gay or lesbian is something that in many communities is just not done. And so in this context, the marriage of convenience is all about covering up that secret.
So take us through how this works. A gay man and a lesbian woman decide to do a marriage of convenience. So they say, oh, we're getting married, and they meet each other's families and they have a big wedding. And then what?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was really fascinated because during the research, I found out that there seems to be a whole kind of industry in marriages of convenience. And that's manifest in various ways. So online, you'll have forums, you'll have club nights, so actual club nights where gay men and lesbians can meet and organize these marriages. Some of the forums actually charge money. So you can pay a subscription, a kind of monthly rate, where people will advertise. And many people from within the South Asian community are really specific. So, for example, I saw adverts where people would say, I'm a 31-year-old man of Pakistani origin living in the UK, and I need someone from exactly the same background who is a lesbian. She has to be over 5'2", and she has to be able to live with my family. So there's a whole kind of checklist that people have. And quite often they'll meet initially online, then meet in person. They'll organize this wedding, and perhaps, you know, some of the people that I spoke to would tell their immediate and closest friends and even their partners about what they were doing, but they would not tell their families. They wouldn't obviously want their cover to be blown. So their families would not know that this wedding was in fact fake. And then moving on from there, they'd have the big wedding. You know, South Asian weddings in the UK, they're a huge affair, you know, often with hundreds, possibly thousands of guests. So they can be really wow. huge. And after that, the couple will then live their life as if they're a kind of loved up couple. And that's the image that they'll project. But on the inside of that home, in the inside of that new marital home, there's a secret. And that secret is often that the couple are living and having an open relationship. So the lesbian woman, for example, will be free to have a girlfriend. The gay man will be free to have a boyfriend. But for the rest of the family, they won't be in on that. And they will effectively think they're a regular heterosexual couple.
How many people are we talking about?
It's very difficult. There isn't any academic or kind of solid research done into the numbers. Now, having said that, anecdotally, one of the contributors said that he believes that a third of all gay British Asians are either looking or are in marriages of convenience. A third of gay British Asians, that's a huge number of people. And I certainly was really shocked by the number of people who were posting adverts online, for example. You know, when I started doing the research for this documentary, I joined certain forums and I was very open about who I was. I'd say I was a journalist and I was looking for contributors. And I was inundated by people who would say, you know, I might be able to help you with your research, a real range of ages, men and women. So there are certainly lots of people from lots of different backgrounds who are engaging in marriages of convenience.
Are there any gay South Asian men or women that you know who have come out to their parents?
Yes, indeed. There are many people that do end up coming out to their parents and being open about their sexuality. But I'd say that's still something that is hugely taboo, particularly within the South Asian community. You know, I think what we need to understand for context is marriage is a huge deal in any community. But within the South Asian community, it's the pinnacle of family life. Quite often in South Asian cultures, when two individuals get married, the wedding is not just about them. It's about the entire extended family. You know, we have this phrase in the community that it's actually a marriage of two families. It's not just about two individuals. So that means there's a huge amount of pressure on gay and lesbian people not to be honest about their sexuality and to conform to this system where they almost invariably have to enter heterosexual marriages. And that has, you know, that has a huge effect on these individuals because effectively they lie. They lie for the majority of their lives.
In your research, did you ever come across a gay man or woman who went through the motions of finding a spouse and was planning a wedding and their family said to them, "We know you're gay. You know, you don't have to do this."
I didn't actually. You know, I think one of the things that lots of contributors said is even if their families on one level might know about their sexuality, they were still really eager to hear about them entering a heterosexual marriage because this often isn't just about the individual. It's about saving face. It's about saving face in front of the extended family and the entire community. So, you know, I remember one contributor saying to me, my parents just looked at me and without saying this, he felt the kind of implication was, you're really trying here. And they encouraged him. You know, he described this as a gay man who married a lesbian. And he said to me very clearly that his wedding day was exciting and he was happy to be entering the next phase of his life. This is someone that ultimately ended up getting divorced after just 12 months. But at that point on his wedding day, he felt the pressure to please his family. And so it's something that the family and he himself just went along with.
Do you think we'll see less of these kind of sham marriages among South Asians as gay rights become more widely accepted?
I would really hope so, and I really think so, actually, because I think even within the South Asian community and amongst immigrant communities generally in the UK, these are discussions which are picking up pace. These discussions are now happening. So these discussions are moving into the public space, and I, for one, think that can only be a good thing.
The BBC's Mobeen Azhar is a journalist and filmmaker in London. His latest documentary is called My Big Fake Straight Wedding. Thanks, Mobeen.
Thank you.
I'm Carol Hills. Coming up, an American spends two decades analyzing the rise of fascism in Germany.
Because I really wanted to put myself there and imagine what was it like to live there when you didn't know what was coming.
Now he's writing a series of comic books about it. That story, plus some banned grandmas, ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and it's The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. President Trump promised to build that wall. He even reaffirmed his commitment to a border wall between the U.S. and Mexico at the G20 meeting today. That's what he's saying, anyway. The U.S. government was supposed to start building prototypes for a border wall in San Diego in June. Well, that deadline has come and gone, and now the government says construction will begin in September. Philip Molnar has been covering the story for the San Diego Union-Tribune. Philip, bring us up to date with this border wall project. I remember the Trump administration had some type of design competition back in April.
Yeah, that's right. So they solicited requests from basically all over. It actually went all over the world, but mostly in the United States, like hundreds of bidders to build these prototypes. And the construction was supposed to start in probably about mid-June was the original date. I think it was June 22nd. And nothing happened.
So if I understand this correctly, the Trump administration put it out there for companies to come up with a design. And so people came up with designs and then some were chosen to be built as prototypes?
Yeah, that's right. So basically, as far as I can count, there was around 460 companies that had offered up designs. Now, they narrowed that down to 20, or the federal government did, down to 20 different companies that they would select. And from them, they would choose 4 to 8 prototypes.
So the Trump administration, did they actually choose the designs that were going to be built into prototypes?
Not as far as I know. They said last week in a press conference they were still going through all the designs.
Do we know why they haven't been selected?
No. I've asked Customs and Border Protection directly why, and have not received a clear answer. And then also some of my colleagues in Washington, D.C. during the press conference last week asked what was causing the delay, and they just basically didn't answer the question.
What has President Trump himself said recently about the wall?
Well, as recently as this morning, he still said at the G20 summit that, you know, he still wants Mexico to pay for the wall. And I know the president of Mexico has said that he would not be doing that. So we'll be seeing there.
But in general, is President Trump talking about the wall less now than he has in the past?
Well, I'm not following him around every day, but it definitely seems like he's speaking less and less. I mean, most people would agree that the border wall was like the keystone of his presidential campaign. And I don't know what that means, if he's sort of stepping back, maybe thinking this isn't going to happen, or maybe he just is busy with lots of other stuff. I can't say for sure.
The wall is a signature campaign promise of Donald Trump. If it doesn't happen, do you think it will cost him politically among Trump supporters?
What I will say is, when I wrote my first story about the border wall being delayed, it got picked up by the Drudge Report, which is a really right-leaning site. And from there, it went around to a lot of conservative media. And there seemed to be, which I was really surprised by, was like a lot of conservative commentators and websites really trying to hold the president's feet to the fire on this border wall, fearing that he might be stepping back from it just because he hasn't been talking about it a lot. And they were using my article as kind of fuel for that. So I can already tell that there's some groundswell out there about if he doesn't follow through with this border wall. But then again, the November election this year was such a surprise for everyone that I'm not sure what's going to happen.
Philip Molnar has been covering the border wall story for the San Diego Union-Tribune. Thanks, Philip.
Thanks so much for having me.
The news out of Venezuela isn't getting better. Food and medicine can still be hard to find, and the anti-government protests are getting more violent. So more and more Venezuelans are leaving. The World's Monica Campbell met up with a couple of them now living in Mexico City. The news from Venezuela on a TV in a restaurant in Mexico City. They're talking about protests, injuries.
Just yesterday, 3 Venezuelan guys come to eat, and when they look at this, they ask me, okay, which channel is this? Then I explain, you have to find in YouTube this.
Eduardo Huejar Garcia works here. He's a Venezuelan, 27, serves arepa sandwiches, and keeps an eye on the news. He's been gone about a year. At first, he figured he'd return soon.
Maybe in 6 months, when I come back, the situation will be different. But I was wrong.
Food and medicine shortages have gotten worse. Protests continue, and this week, pro-government supporters attacked opposition politicians with sticks and metal bars.
Really, it's difficult. And when you put all these things together, this is why you take the choice to leave.
And more Venezuelans are leaving every day. In the U.S., asylum claims from Venezuelans are spiking. Mexico is a big destination, too. Eduardo is here because his brother came here 2 years ago, got a job, and persuaded Eduardo to join him.
He asked me, Eduardo, why you don't try to come here, be stable in Mexico?
This cafe is a slice of home with its Venezuelan food, flags, and Eduardo's face lights up, showing me this big suitcase behind the counter, stuffed with hats and sports jerseys hauled up from Caracas.
We have shirts from Venezuela.
What's the big baseball team in Venezuela?
Los Leones del Caracas, yes.
What's your favorite soccer team?
Soccer team in Venezuela, Caracas Football Club. I love all teams from Caracas.
But one of his favorite things here is a hat with the Venezuelan flag. His flag, he says.
It's our 3 colors, yellow, blue, and red.
And 7 stars, not 8, like on Venezuelan's current flag. In 2006, President Hugo Chavez added an extra star to honor Simón Bolívar, who liberated Venezuela and much of South America from Spain.
really, for me, my flag is with 7 stars because I've never believed in this government and in these things.
His own small protest from afar. But Eduardo knows the price some protesters pay in Venezuela.
I had one friend who studied with me in the university, and now he's dead. He was killed. It's one example which I tell you, maybe in my case I live. He didn't live because he was a person who believed in his country and fight with his country. And he died fighting for his country.
He died fighting for his country.
Fighting for his country, yes.
Do you think you would have been next to him if you'd stayed in Caracas there at the protests?
When I saw these situations, I would like to stay there, help them too.
But for now, he's helping his family.
My mom, my family. I have 2 sisters, 1 5-year-old, and the other 1 3.
His mom has cancer. He sends her money, medicine. He says helping his family from here, it's like being on a plane that starts the nosedive. You grab your oxygen mask first.
I think this situation is the same. For example, my brother left, and now he's helping me, yes? Now we are outside, and we can help her.
I also meet Ulises Hachis, a musician in his 30s. He's warming up for a small show. He says he's here because he can do what felt like an uphill climb in Venezuela, where hyperinflation basically zapped his income and nobody could afford to buy music or see him perform.
Here in Mexico, it's different. Like, I don't know, like being an artist is important again.
Today, Ulises is performing with José Luis Pardo, or Cheo, of the popular Venezuelan band Dos Amigos Invisibles. The musicians are now collaborating in Mexico City. Here's their single called We Came Here.
Será por siempre, será infinito, tendrá la magia que tiene sol.
Ulises knows he's part of an exodus. He withstood Venezuelans' decline for a while.
It was really hard for me and my girlfriend to get water. Like, we had water, running water, like 15 minutes a day.
And the lack of food. Now he sees photos of people back home. They look different.
Tons of people that I know are really thin now. They say that la dieta de Maduro, like Maduro's diet.
Nicolás Maduro, Venezuela's president. For Ulises, though, the tipping point was violence. The store his girlfriend worked at kept getting robbed.
Got robbed too many times. I think for most people I know, that's when they say this is it.
He says going back isn't an option.
It's not like I'm going back to Venezuela, I'm going to get a job and have a regular life. Going back to Venezuela for me is like not eating 3 meals a day. So it's like no-brainer.
Ulises also tells me about another song he's made here called Amuleto, Amulet.
Mi cuerpo es un pauhil. La casa está.
It's all about the feeling that I had about leaving Venezuela and the people in the streets, like protestando.
Protesting, or in the case of more Venezuelans, leaving. For The World, Monica Campbell, Mexico City.
We have more music by Ulises Hachis at PRI.org. You may know I'm a big fan of cartoons from around the globe. They often express what people are really thinking as opposed to what they say. In Vermont, there's an American artist who's taken on a weighty subject in a very methodical way. He's been working for more than 20 years on a comic about the origins of Nazi Germany. The World's Daniel Gross has the story.
Jason Lutz started drawing comics before he knew how to write. Growing up in Missoula, Montana, he would sketch out his favorite superheroes, and his mom would add the words. He used to visit a local tobacco shop and stare up at shelves of comics.
And I remember going in there as a kid with my allowance money, just being completely dumbstruck by this cornucopia of visuals that were, it was like being in a candy shop.
At first, Lutz was interested in the imaginary worlds of superheroes and westerns, but slowly he got interested in history, thanks in part to a video he saw in his high school history class. A video that he never forgot.
You know, the main image I retained from it was bulldozers pushing piles of bodies, piles of emaciated corpses into trenches during the Holocaust. And the feeling afterwards of like, what was that?
Lutz pushed that image out of his mind, and for 10 years he didn't think much about it. In his 20s, he graduated from art school. Then, one day, Lutz was reading a magazine and saw an ad for a book of old photos of Berlin.
In that moment of reading just this ad copy, I decided that the next comic book I was going to do was going to be about Berlin in the 20s and 30s, and it was going to be 600 pages long. And, you know, 23 years later, I'm almost done with this book.
Lutz spent 2 years researching before he started to draw. He learned about how democracy collapsed in Germany, how a country known for art and science descended into violence. In the first chapter of Lutz's comic Berlin, two strangers meet on a train. Kurt Severing is a journalist, and Marta Müller is an art student. They're drawn in a detailed black and white style that looks a little like old school Superman comics, minus the superpowers. The book is about ordinary life in the run-up to an extraordinary time. Lutz draws in his dim basement in Heartland, Vermont. An old map of Berlin hangs on the wall.
This table here, covered in a big mess, is where I draw my comic book.
When Lutz started his comic, he had never been to Germany. He doesn't speak German. And to make up for his lack of knowledge, he made a rule for himself. He was going to avoid any books and movies that were released after 1933.
Because I really wanted to put myself there and imagine what was it like to live there when you didn't know what was coming.
Lutz didn't want the present day to color his image of the past. Still, the present eventually caught up with him. After one of his books was translated into German, he finally traveled to Berlin.
The sun was setting, and I was seeing these buildings that I'd only ever seen in photographs, and I was in full color, which was crazy because I'd only ever looked at black and white photographs.
He was nervous to hear Germans react to his American perspective, but the response was mostly positive.
I found it a very enriching experience, and still do find it very enriching.
Lars von Turner writes about comics for the Berlin newspaper Der Tagesspiegel. He's read Berlin many times and says it captures an era that's difficult to imagine.
When you walk through real Berlin nowadays, there's not very much left to see from those days.
Which means that Lutz's old books and photographs were a good source.
Maybe even a better source than the actual city, since Berlin has largely been destroyed in the Second World War and after.
Recently, Lutz says he's started to see parallels between German history and American politics. During the 2016 election, rhetoric from candidate Trump made him nervous.
Like, here is basically somebody who's positing himself as a strong man, you know, spouting a lot of the same rhetoric that any strong man throughout history has spouted, including Hitler.
Lutz doesn't think Trump is a dictator. He says today's American democracy is pretty different from the weak German democracy that came before World War II.
What I find most parallel is that Trump has emboldened exactly the same forces that were in play in the 20s and 30s. He's given nationalists and, you know, diehard racists, and he's given them kind of permission to come to the surface.
Before I leave, we walk up the stairs into the living room, and Lutz's son and daughter show me some drawings.
What are we looking at right here?
A picture.
What is a picture?
Can you tell them the different parts?
I don't know, though. It's just abstract. I just drew it.
It may be their father's influence.
For the World, Daniel Gross, Heartland, Vermont.
You can see drawings from Jason Lutz's graphic novel, Berlin, at PRI.org. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills.
And I'm Shirin Jafari. Carol, I've opened up an Instagram account on your computer, and I want you to have a look at some of the pictures there. Tell me what you see.
I see a lot of grandmas, and some are holding a grandchild. Others are looking longingly at the camera. One woman's even holding a giant jar of pickles.
Okay, let me explain why we're looking at pictures of cute grandmas on Instagram. These pictures are posted on an account called Banned Grandmas, and it was set up by two Iranians who are protesting President Trump's travel ban. Last week, the Supreme Court reinstated parts of the travel ban. That's until there's a full review in the fall.
So, Sharon, give us a recap of what the ban says.
The ban was an executive order signed by the president, and it stops people from six Muslim-majority countries from coming to the U.S. So if you're from Syria, Iran, Libya, Sudan, Yemen, and Somalia, you'll not be issued a visa to come to the U.S. for 90 days. President Trump says this is necessary to keep us safe.
So where do the grandmas come in?
So here's where the story about grandmas come in. When the Supreme Court reinstated part of the ban, it said that if you're a national of one of these countries and you have a close relative in the U.S., then you're exempt.
Yeah, I remember the word was bona fide relationship. And so what constitutes a bona fide close relationship?
The State Department says parents, children, spouses, son-in-law, daughter-in-law, siblings are close relatives, but not grandparents and not aunts and uncles.
Why not grandparents?
That's a question a lot of critics are asking, including the woman behind this Instagram account. I spoke to one of them. Her name is Holly Douglas.
This travel ban is absurd and unfair and unjust, and it's not tackling the greater issue, which is terrorism. They come to the United States to visit family, to spend time with their loved ones, to attend special occasions, whether it's graduations or weddings, and God forbid, in certain cases, funerals. And nobody has ever heard about a grandparent committing a terrorist attack. And I don't know anybody that hasn't had a really good and close relationship with their grandparent.
Holly told me she herself was born to an Iranian mother and an American father. Her grandma passed away 4 years ago. But like she says there, she really doesn't understand the point of banning grandparents from the U.S. One final point, Carol. The state of Hawaii has been trying to get clarification on why grandparents are not considered close relatives. And it just wants grandparents to be taken off the list. But just a couple of hours ago, a judge rejected this, and he said that the state can ask the Supreme Court for more clarification.
The World's Shirin Jafari. Thanks, Shirin.
You're welcome, Carol.
Finally today. You might not know it, but there's a large Yazidi population in Lincoln, Nebraska. Some Yazidis from Iraq have been there since the 1980s. Others came more recently, after escaping from ISIS with their families in 2014. This music was recorded in the Yazidi community in Nebraska, and it was gathered by members of the nonprofit group Music in Exile. Sasha Ingber is co-founder of Music in Exile, and she told us about one Yazidi man she met in Lincoln. His name is Hassan.
We would normally go into people's homes, but we actually ended up meeting Hassan at his barber shop. He actually has a music studio to the side of the barber shop. So when you walk inside, immediately, just to the right of the barber chairs, is this area where he makes music.
That's amazing. So he gets people to come in for haircuts and to record music.
It was really remarkable, the juxtaposition of the two, and he found a way to blend them. He would stand and he would play the keyboard for us, and while he was doing that, there was a man who was cutting hair, and the man who was cutting hair and the man who was sitting there having his hair cut were kind of dancing. Hassan really likes to blend different cultures, and so here is Hassan talking about the blending of music from all over the world.
Some of the music I play interests me a lot is Mexican guitar. I play that with my keyboards, even with Yazidi songs. I like the native Indian flute, the Turkish strings. I play a lot of Turkish style stuff, Arabic, Egypt. I listen to a lot of Egyptian music.
Is the goal of Music in Exile to document musicians in exile, or to educate people about musicians in exile, or both?
Music in Exile is trying to do multiple things at one time. We want to preserve this intangible cultural heritage so that when someone moves to another place, they can pass on to their children and their grandchildren this music that might be forgotten when they're no longer in these communities. But we're also trying to let people in the United States who might not necessarily meet a person from Iraq or from Syria or another country who's been displaced, let them understand a little bit of their culture. The songs are a way to get them to start sharing a part of their lives. It's a way for us to learn about what matters to them. It's a chance for us to come into their homes and be introduced to this whole other world. And it often lets us learn so much more about them before they were displaced, which is really important because I think that a lot of the times refugees are seen as statistics and they aren't humanized. It's important to know that they have their own stories. They have their own memories. There are things that they miss. For instance, Hassan talked about how when he first arrived in the United States, he was really overwhelmed. He missed his community. He missed all those familiar faces. And there were so many buildings. There were so many cars. He used to go on the roof and take birds out and fly them back and forth. And there are all of these things that they miss, and they don't just come to a new country with a fresh start.
Sasha, do these musicians, do they do any outreach outside their community? Perhaps to other residents in Lincoln, Nebraska?
I think that more emphasis is placed on working inside their own communities, playing music together, going to events together. But the generations that have been more established in Nebraska and Lincoln, people who came in the 90s, they seem to be more able to do outreach outside of their own communities. So they might go and perform in a church, or they might have friends who are American and have been born in the United States. So, you know, it kind of is like varying levels of outreach based on how long they've been in Lincoln.
Sasha Ingeber is co-founder of Music in Exile. It's a nonprofit based in Washington, D.C. Thanks, Sasha.
Thanks so much for having me.
Eric Goldberg composed the world's theme music. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Have a great weekend.
PRI, Public Radio International.